And welcome to Aryan Insights. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and today we have a bit of a different programme for you. My guest is an economist who claims to have a solution to the problems caused by the capitalist economy that will not lead to the same problems encountered by the socialist system, where everything is owned by the state. His solution is based upon the National Socialist one of the Third Reich, but brought into the 21st century through the help of modern technology. His name is Kurt Romer, and his system is called the San Francisco Model of Economic Adjustment, or SFECON for short, and he has taught at San Francisco State University and the University of San Francisco. His students have published academic papers on his model, and he is due to present one of his own in Lisbon this summer. Our enemies have accused him of being a Nazi, an anti-Semite, and a racist in their attempts to silence him, but his students were so supportive of his work that they continued to work with him, even after he had been removed from his position. In fact, it was one of his students that first contacted me and suggested I interview him, as his theory does stand up to scrutiny, and the alt-right really does need a good alternative economic system to promote. We cannot just say that we need to abolish usury, or we need to do away with the banks. We need to have a system of economics ready to replace our current one, one that is firmly based on the ethnic state and a continuation of the Western scientific tradition, instead of the Jewish Kabbalah. Kurt's system works for the benefit of the people, instead of the people working for the benefit of the system, with profits being paid out in dividends to the people who most deserve it. A computer simulation has been created, making all the calculations required to solve the problems inherent in our current economy, which was created by Jews at the end of the war and requires a constant increase in debt just to pay the compound interest. In our discussion, we talk about what the problems are in our current paradigm, how the National Socialists attempted to solve them, and the potential flaws in their solution, which Kurt has solved. We talk about the problems in the university system and his time at MIT as a student, and then later at the universities as an instructor. He explains why the Austrian School of Economics goes against the Western scientific tradition and just what he means by Western scientific tradition. We also talk about the different responses to corruption among the races and how the Asians, who are supposed to be so clever, have no scruples about cheating and even encourage it. He also claims to have solved the famous Vienna problem, which sets out the reasons for why a socialist economy will always fail. So I started the conversation by asking him to explain just what the Vienna problem is for our listeners. Hello, Kurt. How are you doing today?
Doing very well, Sven. I hope you are as well.
Yeah. It's a beautiful sunny day here in Britain. And I've been looking forward to our conversation for quite a while. I suppose what we should start off with is the Vienna problem, because you claim to have solved the Vienna problem, and the Vienna problem is right at the heart of economics, and it's almost like a holy grail of economics, and you claim to have solved this, and also while using a National Socialist influence from in the 30s and the 40s and what they did with their economy. So I think we should probably start off with a layman's explanation of the Vienna problem, so that our listeners who aren't aware of what it is know what it is that we're talking about.
Okay, well, I'll do my best. The Vienna problem, also called the socialist calculation problem or the economic computation problem, is a challenge to represent all the activities in the whole economy, and to show how those activities advance the economy from any disordered state to a unique state called the general economic optimum. So if we're going to discuss this problem, we're going to probably go down two channels, at least momentarily. First, what are these economic activities, and do they really represent the economy? And second, what really describes this uniquely desirable optimum? Okay, if I'm making sense so far, I would say that the solve problem has got to represent the physical rates of all outputs. It's got to account for the assets being used up in those production processes. It's got to distribute the products to replace the assets being used up. so that you eventually create and sustain an optimal distribution of assets. And this continuous redistribution of assets, guided by prices, which results in financial flows, which have also got to go somewhere and mean something. If we can go on, if that sort of sounds like an economy to you, then we can go on and discuss the optimum. First thing to know is that the optimum has a quite precise algebraic definition that I'm not going to hit you over the head with. That it is precise. If the Vienna problem is solved, you can tell with mathematical certainty that it is solved. The definition of the optimum has a number of verbal equivalents, and we can toss a couple of those out and try to get comfortable with them. First of all, optimality is a situation in which all opportunities for extraordinary profits have been driven out. This was formulated by a fellow named Vilfredo Pareto as a situation where no one can increase their profits without causing even greater decreases in profits everywhere else in the system. I hope that sounds like an optimum. And we can put this another way. The optimum distribution of assets is one in which every economic sector will value any given asset at exactly the same price. So I hope that sort of tells the audience that if we're not at the optimum, we're probably going to adjust toward it. Now, that would be my layman's summa. How are we doing so far?
Yeah, that sounds okay. So it's a way to determine what the just price is for everything and to distribute what's needed or distribute the assets among the industries so that they're used to optimum proficiency, or to distribute the capital among the industries so that it's used to optimum proficiency. And this
yes,
is something
that's entirely you've got it.
And this is something that can be computed. It's something that can be forecast on a computer that can tell you what needs to be done. And at the moment, we have it with markets. Is would that be correct? The trading, these traders, where they trade shares, and that determines the movement of the capital around the assets. Is that right?
Well, yes. Basically, it is said that we need to have the activities of Wall Street and the City of London, so that large capital-intensive operations can know how much capital they're entitled to, how much is optimal for them to use. If you will, financial casinos where people bet whether or not capital is where it needs to be or if it needs to be someplace else. And in that process, we price the big, complicated assets of the economy, and those prices are our guidepost to get those assets toward the technical optimum.
So at the moment, it's determined by people just buying what they want of what they think is going to make the money, and then that drives the prices up on things, and we end up with prices that are too expensive for people to afford. But what we should have is a just price for things, so things that are needed by people, they can afford to buy them, and there isn't a huge profit put on them because more people need them. Would that be right?
Yes, that is the case. Basically, there is a proper level of profits that is neither offensive nor too small to make the system operate, and that is discernible by artificial intelligence. And, of course, that's the controversy in my little life, is whether or not it is discernible by artificial intelligence.
Because you claim to have created a program where that solves this problem, and you've had this for quite some years, but you've been silenced, and they've also accused you of being a Nazi and anti-Semitic, just purely for solving this problem, because there seems to be some Semitic influence or some benefit to them to keeping this problem as being unsolved. Would that be correct?
Well, yes, there is a benefit to a certain class of people. Now, they aren't all Semitic. As a matter of fact, the wealthiest families here in the United States, and I believe as well there in England, are indifferently as to their ethnic origins. But it is in the interest of wealthy people that the problem not be solved, because wealthy people think they are making the economy work well for us by playing around with trading equities, and taking risks and taking those and trading those equities. Now, if the markets for equities were supplanted by a robot, then the usefulness of their fortunes would go away, and the fortunes would probably go away as well. So there is, shall we say, a vested, and I'll call it elite interest in seeing to it that that problem isn't solved. If there's a Semitic aspect to it, I think it's fair to observe that the social sciences are almost exclusively populated by Semitic people. And their culture being different than ours, their economic science is rather different than what I would call Western economic science.
Yes, because you say that this fits in with the Western tradition and the Western scientific tradition. This problem that we have with the prices going up and the things that we need being priced out of our price ranges and these monopolies, all this sort of thing is something that the socialists thought that they were going to fix by having the state ownership of everything. And they wanted to get rid of private property and then have everything owned by the state. But even this doesn't solve the problem either, does it? Could you explain the reasons for that?
Well, yeah, the problem is if you have, shall we say, sole ownership of the, let's call them the commanding heights of economic order, then, as you say, the equity shares in these commanding heights are not traded. You don't know what prices would reflect the technologies in those assets. The technologies change. We lose our signposts that point us toward the optimum. So eventually, the system will spiral out of control because you won't know the point to which to correct the economy. The economy will lose sight of that when the prices aren't valid. So when the economy goes bad, it's, of course, perfectly normal for the population to say, somebody step in and get control of this thing. Wipe out that financial superstructure. Break the economy down to something simple, physical, manageable. Manage it with good sense. Forget about the optimum. Just do something sensible, which is what the Axis powers, all three of them, did. They disentangled their domestic affairs from the global financial chaos that was going on. And they made the most of the human assets within their borders. And since they had pretty solid human beings within their borders, that they were able to accomplish a great deal. That's not the same thing as getting all the way to an optimum and controlling it. That's simply doing the sensible thing in very distressed circumstances. Now, I would assume, I don't know, but if, let us say, Operation Barbarossa had been a success, if Germany would have been a socialist local hegemon in the middle of Europe, that Germany would have gone off the rails even as the Soviet Union did in 1989, even as the Western world is as we speak.
Didn't the Allies change that part of their economic system after the war to reflect partially what the Axis powers had done?
Well, it was really much more central than that. It has been observed by sympathetic Keynesians that John Maynard Keynes developed his theory out of observations on what was going on in Germany. And I think that is true. It might be shocking to say it, but the Nazis were the first Keynesians. And incidentally, in parallel times, Oswald Mosley was very much a Keynesian in his own right. So I think people trying to be good politicians in times of economic distress all hit on approximately the same solution. And we'd have to agree it was a solution that would at least help for a decade or so. And of course, you're right in observing that the Allies adopted Keynesianism after the war, and that's been the governing ethos ever since. And it's, falling apart on us now.
So the idea would be to start again with a new system, to wipe out the debt that's there already and start again with a new system. Would that be the best suggestion, do you think?
Well, yes. The wisest thing to do would be to blow out or reduce a lot of the big monetary aggregates, which, as I say, are the wealth of very important families. Wiping out large sections of our financial aggregates would lower prices, and people would have the purchasing power to go out and buy things and stimulate the economy. Just trying to give them money, of course, raises prices, and the things we want to buy are still out of our reach.
And this is the way it used to be done before, wasn't it? There used to be, all the debts used to be wiped out after a certain amount of time. And this was done back in antiquity by various different cultures. We read about it in the Bible. You hear about it in Alfred the Great's law. You hear about it being done in Rome. But we haven't had it done in the modern world, and not since back then.
Well, let me first of all agree with your interpretation of history. There were wise men in history who had gotten to the point where Western civilization is now, and they did just as you said. They had jubilees, and they simply canceled debt, and they did so quite commendably. For example, when Solon did it in Athens, he was a politically very potent man because he convinced his own social class that they had to impoverish themselves somewhat for the good of the nation. When we come forward to this modern phenomenon called capitalism, that process tends to happen naturally. It would seem that every 8 or 10 years there would be some sort of financial crisis and equity values would collapse, prices would collapse, and people would find that the things they need are within their capacity to buy them, and the economy would revive. So capitalism, with its periodic failures, does what great personalities in history, I think you're referencing Nehemiah, did, and did so effectively. Our problem now is that our governments have been captured by elite personalities who don't want to let that happen. You know, we don't have a Solon among our aristocratic classes.
Instead of giving the money to everyone to increase the purchasing power, to increase production, they've ended up bailing out the richest people who've kept the money to themselves, have ended up bailing out the banks. Whereas really, the money should be distributed among everyone so that they can purchase more and stimulate growth. Would that be a solution to it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And of course, this is done in broad daylight. The greatest thefts of all time happened, I think, in 2007 and 2008. The wealthy class is no longer beneficial. They aren't really taking chances with their grandfather's money. They are demanding to have their losses made up by the taxpayers, and they're succeeding at it.
What your system would do would provide the currency that was required, or the capital that was required for industry in order for the industry to grow, and then the capital would get paid back, and it would be at an optimum rate for the industry. And what would happen to the money when it went back? Would it be zeroed, or would that still retain its value?
Well, you are getting to the heart of economic science, which makes it so difficult. It's the question of what money is. And, I'll try not to be too esoteric here, but when students finally pin me down and say, what, after all, is money? I ask them, well, what is civilization? And I steer them toward Nietzsche's answer. Well, civilization is a system of obligations, and money is just the way we measure those obligations. If you start from that point of view, then you can say that at all times in civilizations, obligations are being undertaken, obligations are being paid off, and money is just the picture of that happening. So I think if we have a quasi or mixed capitalist economy, you have to understand that money is being created all the time, wherever it is needed. Money is also being abolished at all times, wherever it is not needed. And that's a normal process, and you can, believe it or not, keep track of it. So if we were, if you will, designing our Fourth Reich here, the state would own not all property, but it would own the big concentrations of capital. It would manage that capital for a profit. It would use those profits for the expenses of the state. And then we might hope that they would take the money left over and declare a national dividend, and simply spread the money out, not as wages for make-work projects that are not optimal, but simply as a dividend that the general public can spend as they wish, which is the definition of optimal. And that kind of, if I may, seems to me to touch upon the social credit ideas of Major Douglas. And I have noticed that those ideas have a certain currency there among white nationalists.
Well, I like the idea of the state making the profits like that. Surely that would mean that there would be less taxes if there were any taxes at all. Would that be right?
There would be no taxes at all. I mean, any economist will tell you the worst thing you can do is tax income. Situation exists in some, you know, concrete ways now, and it might be useful to perhaps describe one of them for the audience so they know what we're talking about. As you might know, our American state of Alaska owns, the state owns, a lot of the mineral rights in Alaska, and they exploit those rights, and they do declare a state dividend. So if you're an Alaskan citizen in good standing, you get a check every year. And of course, the state could manipulate that process. You can say, if you have four children, you get a big check. If you have no children, you get a small check. If you're a bad person, you don't get any check. Lots of social options. I'm just saying the way to run our Fourth Reich would be to have efficiency first and foremost. Squeeze all the profits you can out of the economy. And having been relentless in those pursuits, then be kind in the distribution of the profits.
So you're not squeezing the people, you're squeezing the economy, and the economy is working for the people rather than the people working for the economy.
That is a very nice formulation, and I think it's kind of like the economic system being parallel to what it seems to me the white nationalists want to accomplish in the political system. We're trying to tell the governing class, we're not here for you. We are not your subjects. You are our tool. You are there to do things that we need to do in a collective way. And the economic equivalent of that is to say to the wealthy elites, you know, we're not just input to the economic system. The economic system is there for us. It's not about our labor. It's about our leisure. And the economic system is there to make profits, so that we get dividends, so we can be at leisure more, so that we're not worried about being unemployed.
Well, what would be the unit of currency then? Because you hear a lot of people that talk about the gold standard. Oh, we should go back to the gold standard. And personally, I think that that's probably not a good idea. There isn't enough gold. You have to dig it up, and there's a lot of work to create that gold. And if, as you say, money is a form of obligation, and that's based on the worth of the country to pay back its debts, basically. If the country can pay back its debts, then its money is worth something. If a country can't pay back its debts, then it's like Zimbabwe, and the money isn't worth anything at all. So we don't actually need a physical representation of it, such as gold. We just need something which tells us what the value of it is, and our own worth can, you know, our worth in paying that back, and the work that we do can give that value. So would it be based on gold, or what would it be based on, this new unit of currency?
Well, this is a fundamental problem in economics as well. Keynes, and believe it or not, I'm not Keynesian, but Keynes spoke of what he called the bancor. In our little SF econ group, we call it the global currency unit. One of the good things about solving the Vienna problem is you will necessarily create a completely abstract reference quantity. There will be only so many units of this reference quantity for all time, and all prices will be grounded in what that reference quantity is. It is a complete abstraction. It is a calculation. It is something the general public can watch the government doing when it decides how much of this general currency unit there is. And the central authority can print money in relation to that fixed standard. So, yes, there is the potential for completely new money. We can see that potential in operation in the Bitcoin phenomenon. And the trouble with Bitcoin is, of course, that it doesn't have a visible unit of value at its core as a reference. And I'm saying I invite your attention to what I call the fact that you can have that reference. It can be abstract. The public can watch you computing that reference, and the ruling class can talk to the public in terms of that reference. And you can, yes, control your currency.
So would then countries that were a part of this system, would they say they, in Britain we have pounds, so the pound note would be worth a certain fraction of one of the units of the global currency, and that fraction would be slightly different to the American dollar, would be a different fraction of the global unit of currency. Is that correct?
Yes, that's entirely correct. Again, to put some operational significance on it, if you were to visit America with your Visa card and your accounts there in England or in pounds, you should be able to travel all over America, buy things, sell things, add, subtract from your account, and the central monetary authority could interpret your transactions instantaneously, translate them from dollars to pounds, even as the relation between dollars and pounds changed continuously during your trip. And again, that can be a perfectly transparent process. If it's honest, people can see that. If it's not honest, they can see that too.
And would this be able to be introduced as a parallel system, such as Bitcoin as a parallel system to the other currencies that we use? Would it be able to be used like that, introduced slowly like that?
Yes, I think that's exactly how it will be introduced. I mean, I hope somebody sees the same things I do and sees the Bitcoin frictionless currency, sees the cyber currency as the wave of the future, and kind of grasps a system of valuation such as I offer with my problem onto that, and makes the whole process transparent, and people will use that currency because it will be the honorable currency while nations are destroying all the other currencies.
Well, at the moment, our systems are all based around debt, and they're based around how much debt that a country has, and this sovereign debt that keeps building up. And part of the reason for this sovereign debt building up is also to do with interest, because there just isn't enough money in circulation to pay back the debt plus the interest. So in order to get the money to pay the interest, they have to put out more loans. So I see that there's a bit of a problem with interest. But you say that that there is room for a small amount of interest. So I was wondering whether you could explain that bit possibly.
Well, once again, I will do my best. First of all, I think you're entirely correct in saying that money is debt. And as you might know, there's a public banking movement here in the United States that says, yes, money is debt, and no, it shouldn't be. Okay, I think those guys are wrong. I don't think there's anything at all wrong with money being debt. Now, that can be arranged honorably or dishonorably. If we, let us say, spontaneously create money to give to somebody, I'm talking about outright counterfeiting here. We give the advantage of the first use of that money to a human being. That person goes and builds a factory. He starts making profits in that factory such that he can pay interest on the debt, then I'm saying that creation of money was honorable and it needed to happen. If, by contrast, this person takes the money and doesn't build anything that starts generating its own cash flow, then the transaction is dishonorable, it's harmful, it destroys money. So in my little system, money is created wherever it's needed. But the system is smart enough to know whether it's needed or not. So the problem we're having now is, yes, we are creating loans, we are creating money, but there's no place to put the money where it will earn a profit. So I'm saying if you create money and it generates more money by earning a profit, then you're really okay. You have a one-time shot of inflation, but it's not the continuous inflation you're afraid of. We get the continuous inflation is where people create money for no purposes or for evil purposes.
And the profit goes back into the system and gets reused again for production and eventually ends up in the dividend for the people.
Yes, and though prices, as you say, will have gone up because money was created, people have the money in hand to pay the higher prices, and nobody is really hurt. And I would like the alternate right to understand that fact, so they aren't afraid of letting money be created and be destroyed. Because if you don't allow that, again, this is a complicated mathematical assertion, you will cause the economy to go unstable. So I want you to look at this creation, destruction of money as a sort of safety valve or a governor on the economic system.
And I think money does have to be a debt as well, if it, with your definition of it as being an obligation. An obligation is like a debt, isn't it? So you're obliged to pay it back.
Yes, exactly. I mean, in Nietzsche's formulation, he points out that the essence of civilization is obligation. First of all, if you bring children into the world, you're obligated to support them. If you support them when your children are older, they are obligated to support their parents when their parents can no longer work. Now, that's the first inescapable instance of generating and dispatching an obligation. Now, that same sort of double entry bookkeeping rules the business world, and people create money simply by extending credit. And they destroy money simply by paying credit off. The thing about obligations in the formal business sense is they have to be precisely calibrated. They have to be measured in some unit, and money is that unit. Whereas our obligations to our parents and to our children are simply what they are. We don't put a dollar value on them.
And it's strange if we were to actually calculate them to the precise value, but I don't think people would be very pleased with it. And yet with the economy, then it has to be done like that. It's interesting that what you're talking there about Nietzsche. I know that there's also an old Hindu quote saying that we're obliged. The first person we owe a debt to is your mother with the mother's milk, which is just given for free. And then you can go back from there to, all the people that went before you that provided everything, your clothing, the house, the furniture, everything that goes before us. We are obliged to them for that, and we pay that back by doing what we can for the next generations that follow. I mean, that's the nationalist ideal, is seeing ourselves in a link in a chain. This economic system seems to be built up in a similar way. So it's conforming to nature, basically, and the natural order, from what I can see of it. And you've said that it fits in with Western science. Could you expand a bit on that, or maybe some of those subjects?
Okay, let's start with science in the Western tradition descends from solved problems. The Vienna problem is said not to be solvable. So a Western man is not going to bow down and worship a problem he can't solve. He's going to solve it, or he's going to find a way around it. So that would be step one. My SF econ system, as we call it, starts with a solved problem. Now, the problem we solve is a dynamic problem. It portrays economic activity in time. If you're going to solve problems like that, you're going to have to use uniquely Western mathematics. You're going to have to use hyperbolic transcendental functions. And I won't hit you over the head with what those are, but you can see the geometries of these functions in the great cathedrals of the 11th and 12th centuries. Anyway, they are essential to dynamism. And as certainly your audience knows, our Faustian culture is dynamic in the definition given to it by Spengler. Spengler, as you know, also said the essence of a civilization can be seen in their mathematics. Well, our Western civilization and our art, our portraits, our biographies, our landscapes, our journeys, our art is dynamic, our architecture aspires to the heavens. And I use the same mathematics that are behind all of those, if you will, dynamic Faustian processes. And what is more, I would presume that if you can take Western science and force it into the field of economics, Western civilization advances by that process. You know, we are invigorated. Human prosperity becomes an engineering problem. Within our societies, people do not have to worry about being desperate. If you're a good person, you will be taken care of. And we will have the wealth to do that. So yes, I think I'm being a good Western man here, and I wish more of my countrymen appreciated that.
Well, I think that's great. It fits in with everything else in our civilization that is now becoming corrupted. I mean, the economy is such a large part of everything. I mean, where the money comes from, that's who our politicians are subservient to. Whereas with this system, then the politicians would be subservient to us and the economic system would be working for us. And the people that you told this to, though, at the MIT, when you were working on this, they didn't take too kindly to these ideas for some reason. I mean, what happened when you tried introducing them at the MIT?
Well, that's kind of a long story. I don't know if it's poetic enough to be interesting, but I got the germ of the solution to the problem not when I was at MIT, but in the year I spent working in Boston. Between college and graduate school before I went to MIT. And I was studying economics in order to challenge my courses at MIT so I didn't have to pay for them. And economics looked ridiculous to me, and I thought what they were trying to convey to me could be reduced to a handful of equations. So I developed those equations and just stayed up one night and did it. When I got to MIT, everything happened swimmingly well when I was there in my first semester. My thesis supervisor, a name you might know, Robert Merton, rather famous as the theoretician behind the long-term capital management debacle. He's a nice person, by the way, in spite of that, was my thesis advisor, and I put this in front of him, and he was very positive about it. His buddy, Myron Scholes, also a name famously associated with long-term capital management, also came in and looked at it. So I had the attention of two very bright, energetic young men. Merton, as you may know, was the protege of Paul Samuelson. In the year I was at MIT, Samuelson was America's first Nobel laureate in economics. So I was very quickly, within a month or so, showing up on campus in the office of the then reigning Nobel laureate. A fourth economist was there, Robert Solow, who would win the Nobel Prize in Economics a few years later. So there I was in the belly of the beast. And unfortunately, Samuelson just simply said, nobody at MIT will work with you on that thesis. He didn't really say why. But if you're Paul Samuelson at that time and you say something like that, then your academic career is over.
Shocking. So they don't even give you a reason why.
It wasn't his, basically. And it's a sort of not invented here syndrome. In other words, if the problem could be solved, Samuelson would have solved it.
Okay, so he saw it as a bit of a slight to him that he hadn't actually managed to solve it himself. And I don't believe you were a nationalist at this time either. That came later on, wasn't it?
No, I would say I was conservative. I kind of got my politics. I'll date myself here during the candidacy of Barry Goldwater here in the United States. I thought Goldwater was a sensible man, and Lyndon Johnson was a mountebank, and that's the way I felt about it then. I was a reader of the National Review, so I was conservative. If you had sat me down at the time with Evola or Yaki, I would have not complained about it. I would have said, yeah, these guys have got it right, but I just wasn't conscious, really, politically at the time.
That's because later on you got accused of being a Nazi for your theories, and you weren't aware that they were National Socialist at the time. I think this was later on at San Francisco State University. Is that correct?
Yes. After, MIT wouldn't really indulge my academic fantasies, I grabbed an MBA from MIT and came back home to California to make some money. And I was a businessman in California then. Incidentally, in that time, I tried to get into the University of California to study economics and got the same difficulty. you're just not going to be able to work on it at the University of California, period. So anyway, I was kind of an everyday hedonist in San Francisco, I'm sorry to say, and I was injured. And in order to do something while I was injured, I started teaching at the State University there in San Francisco. And I introduced my academic interests, and they were well received by the people who knew something about them. But I did run into trouble at State, not really because of my academic interests, which were not that well understood, but it was simply on the basis of appearance. First of all, I gave offense at San Francisco State because I was managing a computer lab there before I started teaching, and some of the faculty had pirated some software and were charging students for it. And I advised them that that was not a good idea. They were not interested in my advice, so I said, "I'm sorry, fellows, I can't be a part of this," and, I was done with it. They, of course, got caught pirating software and deeply embarrassed for it. So I think that was really the source of the animus rather than what I had to say about economics. And also, recalling from that period, the time when a professor rose up to her full 5-foot-nothing and started poking my sternum and informed me that I was a white trash patriarch. So I think that was the first of the Nazi accusations. But basically, go ahead.
Oh, I was just laughing. As you say, even back then, you got the feminists onto you. You hadn't realized, really, that your sympathies were nationalist, and you got the feminists attacking you already, even back then. They were realizing that you were a nationalist before you did.
Well, I think it has to do with appearance, and this might be kind of a jerky thing to say in public, but I kind of look like the guy that the central casting will send over to you if you order up an SS Coronel. I mean, I look very German. I have been addressed in German on the streets of San Francisco by German tourists who expected that I would be able to understand them.
Well, I think form does follow function. People who usually look elegant, they usually have the intelligence to go with it. If you look at back in history, look at Cromwell, a real nasty type that started a revolution, killed the king, and yet he's really ugly looking when you look at him. If you look at in the past when they would create the sculptures, beauty went hand in hand with intelligence. The king was beautiful as well as intelligent. These two things used to go hand in hand. I think form and function.
Yes, and I think they do. Again, if you don't mind me pursuing this venue, I would say that elite opinion in Western civilization now is completely oriented against the continuation of Western civilization. So if a man is not homosexual and he presents himself sort of as the limit of the European genotype, he's a fancy for that reason alone. I mean, I hate to say that. I don't want to make excuses for my own failures because, I'm prettier than other people, but sometimes you come away with that opinion. And if I may add, I think parallel to that, my work in economics is also a furtherance of Western civilization, and it is offensive, once again, for the same reason. Elite opinion just doesn't want the West to continue, and I'm a Western man working in the Western tradition.
That's interesting to hear that it's, we're being attacked in that area as well. We are being attacked in all areas of our culture and our civilization by these other races. And I do think they resent us. They resent us for our appearance. They resent us for our IQ. They resent us for our creativity. What sort of stage then did you come across nationalist ideology then, or national socialist ideology, and when did your interest in their economy arise?
Well, let's see. I would say that the interest was brought to me by former students, by young men, some of whom have been in contact with you. They essentially said, Kurt, forgive the vulgarity here, you were shitlording it up back in the 1990s. I did not think I was. I did introduce students to Joe Sobrin and Sam Francis and Pat Buchanan simply as a matter of their being curious young people, and Buchanan and company had the answers to their questions. So I don't know how you really answer that. I did become curious about the alternate right, about white nationalism a few years ago. And I started studying it. And of course, there are a lot of great resources out there to study it. And it occurred to me that, gee, I hope these guys take an interest in my technology, because it seems to me their technology might not be all it needs to be to accomplish what they want to accomplish. Hence this conversation.
Yeah, well, hopefully people will get something from this, and they'll check your website out, and especially those that are economists and that are interested in the economy. Didn't they go after you at some point? They were accusing you as a Nazi and trying to get you banned from teaching and all sorts of problems at some point. And was that at the University of California, or was that after then?
Well, at San Francisco State, I only taught for one semester, and they actually, prior to that semester, unbeknownst to me, the faculty did petition to have me removed. And the petition indeed said lots of ridiculous things, like Rumer was born in Peru or someplace to some circle around Josef Mengele, and he was the result of selective breeding, and a lot of ridiculous things like that. And they did indeed call for me to be imprisoned and definitely to be kicked off campus. And the dean of the business school there at San Francisco State did exactly that. And he immediately ran into a counter petition from my students for my reinstatement, which he ignored. And as I say, I didn't know about the accusations, and so I wanted to get on with my life. As I said, at the time I was injured. I was involved in a lawsuit against the people who injured me. I did not need the complications. I did need what's called the Blue Cross card here in California. State employees do get free medical care, no questions asked. Since I was injured, I needed that. Anyway, I took my very fine recommendations from my students up to Ignatian Heights in San Francisco, the site of the University of San Francisco, run by the Jesuit Province of California. Introduced myself as a Catholic, said, here are my academic credentials, here's what I did as a teacher at State, and they said, of course, come and join us. And then the trouble started. The State University got in touch with the Jesuits and told them that I was a Nazi, and the Jesuits withdrew the job offer. And meanwhile, in this tort that I told you about, where I was suing the people who injured me, my personnel file from San Francisco State was entered into evidence, evidence that I am a Nazi. So I was successfully accused of Nazism, and I was driven out of the university by it. And not content to screw up my life that way, my former colleagues went to the Hearst Papers in San Francisco and tried to get the whole thing in the press. So I wound up sitting down with a reporter off the record with advance notice that I'm only going to try to talk you out of running the story, which I did. I just refused to be quoted on the record, and they dropped the story. So, yeah, they did their best to make a mess out of my life at the time. Fortunately, they weren't that successful, and I went on to teach at USF, and I won my tort and so on.
Vindictive, really vicious. I'm really glad you got some. You had some good students there who spoke up for you. And this is there's a glimmer of hope there that you know your students stood up for you and got a petition together against the ones that were trying to cause you trouble. And it didn't. When you were looking into the Jesuit thing, didn't you come across a surprising quote actually, which was likening Christianity to the global economic system, or Catholicism to the economic system?
Yes, if I may have the quote here, if I can try to read it. I don't have nearly the speaking voice that you do, but I'll give it a try. This is Robert A. Sirico, the Reverend Sirico. He wrote a book called The Morality of Markets, which is red flag right there. You know, markets are not supposed to be moral. They're supposed to be relentless and efficient. Morality comes later. Sirico was the founder and current president of the Acton Institute here in the United States. That's essentially a Christian community. The last time I looked, they had a lot of Jesuits on their board of directors. Anyway, from Sirico's book, there is a virtuous circle at work here. Christianity, a global religion, played a role in paving the way for economic globalization. And economic globalization then played a role in bringing more people in contact with other cultures and with Christianity, which in turn brings more people into the fold of Christianity. Perfectly reprehensible statement in the eyes of this Catholic.
Yeah, he's sort of hijacked onto Christianity and encouraged it to globalize and encouraged the missionary activity just so that it could inject itself into the dialogue and enslave the countries to debt to the same money system.
Yes, and of course it's going on elsewhere now. The current Pope is, of course, a Jesuit, and he is saying that essentially Western civilization is not entitled to have a southern border, and that has been said by cardinals and bishops here in the United States as well.
They've sold out completely the original national ideal of Christianity, of laying down your life for your brother and loving your neighbor, and they've now turned it into a global industry. And they're even taking part in these banks and encouraging, they profit themselves from the usury and from the poor.
Yes. I mean, look into the Banco Ambrosiano. The Vatican Bank is probably the most corrupt bank you'll find.
Working hand in hand with the Jews all the while they're doing this and just screwing the people. And then on the other hand, they're trying to say that they're being charitable and they look after the people. Whereas with the system that you've got, people that needed looking after would be looked after from the profits that were generated from the industry, from the people that could work.
Yes. I mean, I would have been delighted if I had found a home with the Jesuits, if their character were more along the lines you suggest that it should be, but it just didn't happen.
Well, this is just it. You know, you've got a system that fits in with the natural order, that fits in with the Christian commandments or what Christians are supposedly supposed to go along with, and yet they're not interested in it. They wish to silence it. They don't want the Vienna problem to be solved. They want that to remain occulted and hidden, as if it's something that can't be solved. A solution can't be found for it because they profit all the time that there isn't a solution found for it. And anyone that does prefer a solution will be silenced and attacked. And you are accused of being right wing before you really knew that's what it was. That's the thing that really gets me.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I thought I was just being a civilized human being. Turns out I'm right-wing, which is, I suppose, true. Anyway, I would like to say a good word for the Jesuits here. I don't think they kicked me out of school because of my economics. They are the only people who let me teach economics my own way. So they were rather liberal about that. What they kicked me out of school for was kind of violating what the father president of the university called the Jesuit Catholic value of multiculturalism. So I wasn't multicultural enough. For example, when I caught a couple of Asian kids intimidating a third Asian kid to cheat on an exam, I sorted the matter out and threw the two bad guys out of class. And I had to sit down with the Jesuit, also an Asian gentleman, known as the boy toy of Ignatian Heights, by the way, rather flaming little man. And he had to explain to me that in Oriental cultures, cheating is part of getting credentials. You know, we're selling credentials here at USF. And these guys just did what they had to do to get the credential that they're here for. To which I could only reply, yeah, but they're here in San Francisco on the campus of a Catholic university, and that's not the way we do things here. And I'm telling a priest this. So.
That's an interesting insight into their culture, that they just accept cheating, and even the head of the department or whoever it was that was in authority, he said that was perfectly fine.
Yeah, well, that was a Jesuit priest who had the function of being a counselor to these students. So the students went to him and said I was being a meanie and a racist, and they got away with it.
That's incredible. It does give us some insight to, they keep telling us about how wonderful the Asians are over here in Britain. They keep telling us that the Asians are doing so much better in their schools than we are. But if it's accepted to cheat, then you know, how can you have any faith in the results that they've got?
Yeah, well, it's just a different culture. It's the thing that you guys on the alternate right go into all the time. You know, our European culture is unique, and we better start realizing that our uniqueness is being used against us, and we're going to have to learn to resist that. I would say that Western people, in my experience, have no instinct toward racism. I mean, Sven, if I may perhaps inquire of you for a moment, I would expect that where you live, in a typical day, you might have business with a Pakistani shopkeeper or a Jamaican bus driver or a Hindu magistrate. And not knowing you personally, only knowing that you are a gentleman of Western descent, I would expect that in those transactions, you don't try to embarrass anybody or belittle them. You just take care of the business at hand, and you keep to yourself the fact that you wish they didn't live in your country. Is that the case?
Well, yeah. Thankfully, I don't have them around me anymore. I live in a very rural area, but I have done in the past. I had interactions with them. And my experience has always been to be very polite. I mean, I didn't really understand nationalism. I wasn't a nationalist in my youth, and I would try to be especially polite to these people because I'd heard all these bad things that people were nasty to these newcomers, and they didn't deserve it. And there wasn't that many in the area that I was in. So, and that was my experience of all the people I knew as well. They would go out of their way to be polite to them. To show them how friendly and generous and understanding we are of different cultures. That's the way Western people are, and that's what's being used against us. That's what's being taken advantage of, isn't it?
Yeah, you've got it exactly right. And I had the same experience as a young man here in Northern California. We used to have a guest worker program to pick agricultural produce. They were called the braceros. And these mestizo people had great dignity. They were solid citizens. We admired them. Their children behaved. All was right. And now we're dealing with their grandchildren. And we can't control these people. They can't live with us in a Western civilization. So we Westerners have to get used to the idea that our racial tolerance, our curiosity, our interest in other races is something that is special to us, and we must, without any rancor, without hatred, we must resist being exploited for that very fine quality that we have.
Tend to project our own qualities onto others, believing that they're going to be thinking and acting the same way as we are, because we think that way. That's something that we have to get over. I try to explain that to people all the time. We need to capitalize on what we are good at and capitalize in ways that we know already that we're good at, which is what this economic system does. It capitalizes on the Western way of thinking and the Western science, as you explained earlier. Well, as I said before, a lot of your students really do support you. You've got this website up, which explains everything in great detail. Could you let people know where they can find your project, what they can do to help support you and find out more about SF Econ?
Well, I'd appreciate the opportunity to do just that. First of all, SF Econ, the SF means San Francisco, Econ as in Econ 101. So if you just bang those six letters into your search engine, you will find the sfecon.com website. That's an online ebook, and you can ask for tutoring there. It doesn't cost anything. If you send us an email, a nice person will get in touch with you and guide you through it. And we would like to see you, if you're interested in economics and you know your mathematics, just master the SF Econ algorithm. Take it into the classroom. Challenge your professors with it. Try to make something out of it. And incidentally, that's been going on for some time. As a matter of fact, there was a young man there at the University of Sunderland who got his doctorate based on the SF Econ theory. So you can succeed with it at some universities in some programs. So I'd say just get in touch with us on the web. If you like what you see, you can communicate with us. And if you really have a big project in mind and we can help, we'll help you bring it to realization.
Well, that's the way to do it, isn't it? It's always challenge people that are promoting the other point of view, especially students should challenge all the stuff that they're being taught at school that goes against what's good for white people. I believe you've got a paper that's being presented in Lisbon this summer. Is that right?
Yes, that'll be the most important academic paper that I've been able to get published so far. It has the economic calculation problem title in it over my name. Some of my other students have been able to publish as well. So basically, you can publish on the fringes of economic science where people are mathematically competent. Central to economics, well, that's still a work in progress.
So we need to get people behind the project that are involved in that and can get the message out to the people that need to hear it, really. We really need some of the nationalist groups to look into this and start promoting this as well and suggesting this as a solution to the problems that we have. I mean, it's a global problem. Countries, their currencies are being crashed all the time. We're living in austerity here in Britain, which could be solved by applying some of these ideas that you have, especially the absolving of the debt and increasing the purchasing power of the people instead of taking away all that purchasing power. And the fact that it can all be shown on a computer simulation to function exactly as you say it should function, a functioning economy that works for the people. And it's really a no-brainer that people should start promoting it, I think. Well, thank you very much for coming on, Kurt, and hopefully people will check out your site and we'll see more interest in you. I'll say thank you very much, listeners, for listening, and we'll be back soon with another Aryan Insights.
Tuned in to Radio Aryan.